The next case on the calendar is appeal number 08-2648, United States v. Pasolik. We have Mr. Bo Brindley.
May it please the Court, my name is Bo Brindley, and I represent the defendant appellant, Peter Misalek. The single issue before the Court is whether the District Court abused its discretion when denying Mr. Misalek's motion to withdraw his guilty plea. The evidence in support of a finding that abuse of discretion did occur comes, I think, in three distinct forms and three distinct places. First of all, when making his ruling, when the District Court issued its ruling on the motion and its memorandum, opinion, and order, one of the things the Court indicated in coming to the conclusion was that it relied in part on a document that was described as a Polish passport request form that the Court indicated was Mr. Misalek seeking to obtain a passport. The Court reasoned that because he sought to obtain a passport and was planning to abscond prior to appearing for his first sentencing hearing on August the 24th of 2003, that proved that Mr. Misalek did in fact understand the lengthy sentence that was dictated by his plea agreement and that his claims that he did not know were false.
Well, but his former lawyer said he explained this to him, and the judge believed his former lawyer. So doesn't that pretty much end the inquiry, at least for us? The district judge believed the former lawyer's version, which sounds actually more sensible to me than that this guy went into this thing without knowing or thinking that it would only be a 7 to 10 year term.
I don't think it ends the inquiry for this reason, because the Court issued a memorandum and order, opinion and order describing its reasons for denying the motion. And one of the reasons was it indicated this document led it to the conclusions that I've just described. The problem is, and I think this is undisputed between the parties based on the briefing, the document itself contained personal information for the father, not Mr. Misalek, a birth date, addresses, indicating this was the father's passport request form. And so and no evidence was ever presented at any time, at any hearing, by any witness, to indicate that this was actually, in fact, a document where Mr. Misalek was going to obtain a passport.
And so he already had gotten the passport, right?
Yeah, he had it already. That's correct. He had received it before that.
As a condition of his pretrial release, he had had to surrender his passport.
Right.
And he went in while he was on pretrial release, told the Polish embassy or consulate that he had lost it, and got a replacement, right?
He had a replacement passport. That's correct.
Okay.
And there's this.
So he was in breach of those conditions of his release.
Certainly. Okay. What the Court was relying on is this form that's for his father and not for him. And the problem isn't just that the Court relies on a document and its interpretation of the document is not supported by any evidence that exists. None. That wasn't what the document was. The real problem is in the Court goes on to reason that because of that, the Court can conclude that Mr. Misalek was aware of the extremely lengthy sentence and that he was planning to abscond, and that's why he presented this document. And that just doesn't make any sense at all. It's logically incoherent, because Mr. Misalek went to court on August 24th, 2003, to be sentenced. This document had been presented far before that. If he was planning to abscond, then showing up for sentencing where there was no indication on that day that it would be continued, where he should have had every reason to expect he was going into custody, makes no sense at all. And the Court used that as the logic underlying its decision to deny Mr. Misalek's motion. And if the Court's going to rely on logic that is absolutely incoherent, and an interpretation of a document that's not supported by any evidence that actually exists, then that is an abuse of discretion, and the case should be remanded so the Court can at least consider whether it would come to the same finding without using that logic and without reliance on that document, because That is just simply senseless. The other problem, the second reason I think abuse of discretion is apparent, is because of the terms of this plea agreement itself. Now, the agreement, this is a pre-Booker agreement. And so there is no discretion here in terms of what these guideline calculations. In the memorandum opinion and order, the court suggested that somehow this acceptance of responsibility was going to make a difference here. But that's not true. That's wrong. This plea agreement, the way it worked, he had agreed to a 38 drug quantity, a level offense level 38. He agreed to 4 points for leader organizer. And pursuant to the guidelines, he had to get another 2 points for money laundering. That was the law. There was no discretion. That was a 44 less 2 for acceptance is a 42, dictating 45 years, the maximum sentence in this case when you sum the maximums.
Wait a second. My arithmetic, I think, is a little different on that.
Okay.
I'm with you up to 44, offense level 44, which
yes.
We know gets us off the chart.
Life.
But if he gets 2 off for acceptance of responsibility, he's down to 42.
Yes.
Where the bottom of the range is 360 with 30 years.
Yes.
If he gets the third level for acceptance of responsibility, that takes him down to 324 to 405.
He's down, he got the third level. Correct.
Obviously, the government hadn't committed on that, and the district court wasn't bound by that. But the difference between 27 and 45, they're both stiff sentences, but it's a lot.
27 and 45, that's true. The plea agreement itself didn't give him any indication the government was going to agree to the timely notification point.
Okay. But then... So there was some potential benefit to him there, and we're not dealing here, if I understand correctly, with mandatory minimum sentences. So downward departures would have been available. He was trying to cooperate with the government. He'd be able to argue, even if I didn't convince the court, the government judge, I at least did my best. He'd be able to make all kinds of arguments in mitigation.
He could have tried to argue for downward departures as far as that went. Yes, that's correct. But with respect to the cooperation, his lawyer testified at the hearing that the cooperation provided no information of use and was going nowhere, and that he told him that before he pled. So I don't think the cooperation aspect is meaningful at all. What we're essentially have here is a situation where this guy is signing a plea agreement that dictates that he's likely going to receive 360 months, and there's really no benefit. But the biggest problem, in terms of the dictates of the agreement itself, came from when his attorney was questioned at the hearing and admitted that he didn't talk to him about the possibility of pleading guilty while still contesting some guideline issues. It would not have been a huge contest of issue with respect to drug quantity to change the offense level. Just this, they got the exact right number of pills, essentially, ecstasy pills, to get him to level 38. They could have contested that. Or the leadership. He didn't even know that was an option. And based on the questioning at the hearing, troublingly, it didn't look like his lawyer knew that was an option. Because he admitted he didn't, when asked what you think a blind plea is, he really didn't know. And he indicated he didn't tell his client about that. And one cannot knowing...
He also said he didn't tell his client that the sentence would be 7 to 10 years, and that's what the defendant testified to.
Right, but the problem here, and setting aside, as we indicate in our brief, even if you set aside the defendant's testimony, what you're left with here is, first of all, the reliance on the document and that logic that's inappropriate. And I think the case needs to be remanded to see if the judge would come to the same decision without that. Because I think that there's just no way that that's supportable by any evidence that existed. And then with respect to the testimony of the lawyer indicating that he didn't inform his client about the option of contesting these things, I don't think it's logically possible to knowingly enter a plea if you don't know what your options are. You can't make a decision if you don't know what options exist. And with that, Your Honor, I thank you.
Ms. Tracy?
May it please the Court. Counsel, my name is Tiffany Tracy, and I represent the United States. Your Honors, the District Court did not just abuse its discretion when it denied the defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea because he correctly discredited the defendant's testimony at the evidentiary hearing which directly contradicted the defendant's sworn statements, which were freely given during the Rule 11 colloquy. And the district court conducted a proper Rule 11 colloquy because the defendant was explicitly advised that the three counts to which he was pleading guilty carried that maximum sentence of 45 years imprisonment. First, Your Honors, the district court the defendant carried a heavy burden of persuasion to show that a fair and just reason existed for requesting the withdrawal. And the district court was well within its discretion when it ruled that the defendant failed to meet that burden for several reasons. First and foremost, the defendant's proffered reasons, namely that he thought that he was going to receive a sentence of 7 to 10 years imprisonment, that he was misled by his attorney into thinking that, directly contradicted his freely given sworn statements which were made during the Rule 11 colloquy. That Rule 11 colloquy confirmed by the defendant's own admissions sworn under oath that he understood the maximum penalties, that he understood specifically that he could be sentenced to 45 years imprisonment, that he both read and understood the plea agreement, which also stated that he could be sentenced to 45 years, and the defendant himself confirmed that no one, including his attorney, made any promises to him that induced his plea regarding what his sentence would be. It wasn't until 3 years after the defendant changed his plea that the defendant claimed for the first time that he was misled by his attorney into believing he would get a 7 to 10 year sentence. And again, Your Honor, this testimony directly contradicted those sworn statements at the Rule 11 colloquy, which, pursuant to United States v. Stewart, a defendant has no legal entitlement to benefit by contradicting himself under oath, and thus, when the judge credits the defendant's statements in open court, the game is over. Second, as I already mentioned, Your Honor, the plea agreement itself specifically stated the defendant could be sentenced to 45 years imprisonment, and the defendant admitted at the evidentiary hearing that he both read and understood that agreement. And third, the district court properly credited the statements by the defendant's attorney, who denied, as Your Honors pointed out, telling the defendant that he would ever receive a sentence of 7 to 10 years imprisonment.
What about that attorney's testimony that he didn't know what a blind plea was?
Your Honor, the defense attorney did not testify that he did not know what a blind plea was. And in fact, the record is contrary to what defense counsel suggests. In fact, what the defense attorney said is that he didn't discuss the blind plea using those terms, and that's a quote. What the district court found and what is outlined in its memorandum and opinion order is the district court credited the attorney's statement stating that while he didn't use those terms, meaning the term of art blind plea, that the options available to the defendant as the attorney testified were discussed, including disputing the drug quantity amounts. Similarly, the district court then discredited the defendant's testimony, which was impeached during the evidentiary hearing on several fronts, that he was not told about the blind plea options. Finally, Your Honor, even the defendant himself conceded at the evidentiary hearing under cross-examination by the government that he knew that he could be sentenced to the maximum imprisonment. He knew that he could be sentenced to 45 years. Your Honors, accordingly, it was not error, let alone clear error, when the district court discredited the defendant's testimony, which directly contradicted his sworn testimony, that he understood the possible penalties, the applicability of the sentencing guidelines, and that there were no side deals or promises outside the plea agreement to induce his plea. In light of counsel's arguments regarding that document, I direct the court's attention to the record at 287. That document, that Polish consulate document, which the defendant at the evidentiary hearing admitted that he submitted on behalf of himself and his father, that he signed on behalf of himself, was introduced into evidence. It was both read by the court interpreter during the evidentiary hearing, and then following the evidentiary hearing, it was introduced both in its untranslated form and translated form by the court reporter.
That's Exhibit 7, is that right?
That is correct. It was Exhibit 7 during the evidentiary hearing. And the document itself and the record, it's record, the docket 282, it was attached as two exhibits, Exhibits 2 and 3 to record 282 in the docket. And it says that this form is for persons that finalize their stay in the USA in order to resettle in Poland. What the document also says is that these persons, both Mr. Masoliak and his father, intended to do so by September 30th, 2004. That, of course, did indeed happen. The defendant fled the jurisdiction to Poland prior to that date. And more importantly, Your Honor, the defendant himself, during the evidentiary hearing, admitted under oath that it indicated that it was to the Polish consul that he intended to leave the country of the United States of America. And the defendant said yes, but he added that what he told the district court at the evidentiary hearing, that after he was meant to use that after fulfilling his penalty here, that he believed he was going to be deported back to the country. Well, of course, the document itself belies that.
Was there any discussion at the guilty plea hearing about the potential for surrendering to begin serving the sentence, that is, remaining free until he had to actually report?
No, Your Honor, there was not. Now, what did occur is at that first sentencing hearing on August 24, 2004, the defense attorney did ask at that time for a continuance because there were still issues to be worked out, namely whether the sentence should be served consecutively versus concurrently, and there were many forfeiture issues to be determined. I'd also like to point out that the defendant himself never testified at the evidentiary hearing that he believed he would be immediately incarcerated on August 24, 2004. And that the district court, when it did discuss that Polish document, as well as the passport he obtained the same day in violation of his bond conditions, what the district court found is he found it persuasive because he did so a week prior to the August 24, 2004 sentencing hearing. And the reason that was important to the district court was because under oath at the evidentiary hearing, the defendant said that the first time he found out that he may be sentenced to something other than 7 to 10 years was at that August 24th hearing. And the document itself, the district court properly concluded, belied that claim.
So what's the answer to the defense question? If he was planning to leave, why didn't he leave before that first sentencing hearing?
The record simply doesn't say, Your Honor. The only answer that the defendant gave at the evidentiary hearing is that that was the first time he learned.
Right. I know that's his answer. You don't believe it. So
certainly.
So what do you think maybe asking you to stray outside the record there.
It is outside the record, but here's what we do know from the record, is that, of course, the terms of the written plea agreement meant that there was no surprise to this defendant. He knew that the direct consequences of the plea were that he could be sentenced to the maximum term of imprisonment. And he knew, based on the very thorough and exhaustive plea colloquy, that he could be sentenced to the maximum term. So certainly, the record does not support a conclusion that this was the first time he had heard about it, and that's why he absconded to Poland. Indeed, the defendant himself at the evidentiary hearing said, I knew that's what I could get. Unless the court has further questions, I will conclude by asking that the court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
We have one more minute.
With respect to your question about the blind plea, at the evidentiary hearing, the previous attorney was asked by me how he understood a blind plea. In the words, how do you understand a blind plea? And he indicated a blind plea would be where he would admit his guilt and then not have at that time any secured or definite amount of time of incarceration, but would leave that up to discretion of the court. The lawyer never indicated that he ever told Mr. Misalek he could contest guideline issues while still pleading guilty. He never said that. Furthermore, the court's reliance on that document, Record 282, which was mentioned before, for the reasons I've already stated, I think is incoherent, and the case should be remanded so he can consider the matter without that document and the improper inferences that were drawn from it. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Mr. Brindley, you also were appointed in this case by the court, and we know you've accepted a number of appointments recently, and we do thank you for your excellent service.
Thank you.